There's a fallacy in life, Mike, and it's not apparent to everyone, but here's the fallacy. The fallacy is that we present a great amount of intellectual information, and that information, including our compromises and our assumptions, will drive the negotiation. But what's really interesting is that they do not drive a decision. They do not drive a negotiation. They do not drive a sale. What drives a negotiation is vision. Vision of the adversary. Their vision, not ours.
Hi, I'm Michael Sinoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi, this is Michael Sinoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. I want to welcome all the HMA consultants to this pre-recorded April 27th conference call. You're in for a treat. We have a very special guest, and we're going to be speaking on negotiation. But first, I want to welcome a couple new HMA marketing consultants. I want to welcome Paul Pierno out of Clinton, New York. Paul loves marketing and has worked with marketing with some of the larger banks out in New York, and I just wanted to give him a warm welcome. Also, Mr. Joseph Ratcliffe. Joseph is an expert copywriter, and if you go to the description section on the bios, you'll learn a little bit more about him, and I want to wish them good luck with the system and all the success. Let's get started. I want to introduce this very special guest, and I chose to do a recording with an expert on negotiating because negotiating is everything. Everything you do in life, from your family to business, has to do with negotiation. And I didn't want to just find you one of the negotiating gurus that teach the same old, same old. I found someone who has some sharp contradictions to what the mass negotiation products out there in the marketplace are teaching. And this gentleman's name is Jim Kemp. Jim's the author of two books. One, No, the Only System of Negotiation You Need for Work and Home, and his new book, set to be released, called Start with No. He's the chairman of the Kemp Group, founder, CEO, and president of Coach 2100 Incorporated, and inventor of a decision-based negotiation method. Since 1987, over 100,000 people have used his negotiation training and management system in more than 500 multinational organizations in a diverse array of industries to complete thousands of business transactions totaling over $100 billion. Jim Kemp and his negotiating training and management system have been featured on CNN, CNBC, numerous radio shows, and in the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company Incorporated, Cosmopolitan, San Francisco Chronicle, the Columbus Dispatch, the Christian Science Monitor, and the San Jose Mercury News. Knight Rider Publications declared his negotiating book must reading. Kemp has lectured on negotiation at many prestigious graduate schools. He is a frequent conference keynoter on negotiation and has taught his negotiation methods in 9 countries on 3 continents. For 20 years, Kemp has been one of the best-kept secrets in the corporate world. He works with very strict confidentiality agreements. If you could talk to one of his negotiating clients, they would tell you he loves to hide in the weeds, advising his clients on what to do next in their negotiations. And in the next 80 minutes, you'll hear me interview Jim like he's never been interviewed before. We cover a vast array of topics. I also want to thank the consultants who took the time to send in some specific questions for Jim. We're going to handle those towards the end, and you're going to learn how you can be a better negotiator, how you can negotiate better fees, and how you can negotiate pricing, and how you can negotiate with your client suppliers for better rates to save them money. So let's get going. going. We've got a lot to cover. This is the kind of interview you need to listen to two or three times, and I hope you enjoy it. Become an expert negotiator. You can read some of Jim's free reports and tips over at www.jimcampstartwithno.com. That's www.jimcampstartwithno.com. So what is negotiating, and how much does confidence come into play in this game?
Well, let's start with confidence. Confidence is everything, of course. But negotiation is the most misunderstood term in our arena today. You know, if you think back to the days of Lewis and Clark and Thomas Jefferson and the kings of England and France, etc., there was no such thing as win-win. There was no such thing as collective bargaining. Those were all invented by us human beings in the very early 1900s. So it's really been twisted, the meaning of the word negotiation. If you look at the Oxford Dictionary, which I did many years ago, and I was actually in Hong Kong when I saw it, and the definition said it's the effort to bring about agreement between two or more parties, with all parties having the right to veto. Now, Mike, I didn't invent that. That's right out of the Oxford English Dictionary back in the 70s. But all these twisted meanings of negotiation, I've been in front of literally thousands of people in workshops over the years, back before we had the capability of the Internet and our technology. And in our workshops, I would ask the question, what is negotiation? And people say, well, it's give and take. It's making everybody happy. It's win-win. It's only compromise as much as you have to. So it was always twisted. It's simply making agreements. That is negotiation.
Negotiation, is there a history that you've ever researched of it? I hear that the Middle East are incredible negotiators, and they are brought up and taught to negotiate, where here in the United States that is not true.
You're exactly right, but the reason they're brought up to negotiate is survival. They've got to make agreements to survive. And here in America, we don't have to make agreements to survive. What we're trained to do, sadly, and I've studied this in depth, Mike, I've got to tell you, and what we're trained to do is compromise. We are trained to be smart, so we make assumptions that get us killed, and we compromise. And it's really a sad state of affairs. Now, just so you know, this compromise mindset, this assumption-based mindset, again, came about in the very late 1800s, early 1900s with collective bargaining in the labor movements, and it was mandated in actual law. It's an act of Congress. The Railway Labor Act is an act that was brought about by Congress to collectively bargain, where you're forced to compromise or you're not bargaining in good faith. You could actually be sentenced to prison if you did not bargain in good faith in those situations. So our society is steeped in compromise and assumption. And, of course, you know, assumption is a terrible thing, and I'll tell you why. Because we're trained to be smart. I mean, every child comes home to look for the pat on the head from the great grade card, the A. So we're supposed to know. We're supposed to know all. And so you'll hear people say things like, and I'm sure your consultants all over the world, they'll hear people say things like, I think, in my opinion. Well, I've had a lot of experience. I know what they'll do. I know what they're thinking. Those are all literally killer statements that people make that get them in terrible trouble and cost them millions of dollars.
If you were to study a culture and you didn't know anything about negotiation, what culture would you study to learn the most? Who do you think are the world's best negotiators culturally wise?
I think women.
Why?
They're not even a culture, right?
That's right.
I've got to tell you, I've trained negotiators in Russia. I've trained negotiators in Africa. I've trained negotiators in Tel Aviv. I've trained negotiators in Egypt. I've trained negotiators. I've got clients throughout the Middle East. I've got clients on the mainland of China. Culture doesn't matter. All the people who think culture is so, now, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying the culture and the respect for culture is not important. But what I am saying is that the way decisions are made on mainland China, they're made the same way in Russia, the same way in the United States, the same way in Antarctica. It doesn't matter. That happens to be a fact. Now, the brain works the same. But why I say women is because women have a very solid tie to their emotions. They're very visual in many cases, and women make exceptional negotiators. If you think about the number of moms in the world who could see things the kids shouldn't be doing and would keep that rule alive that, no, you cannot do that, that will hurt you, those kinds of things, that ability is something that's extraordinary.
How is negotiation different from selling?
Well, that's interesting. I'd love to hear someone say, well, I'm going to convince them to do this, I'm going to sell them on that, and I'm going to bring about this, and I'm going to demonstrate that, and I'm going to prove it to them. I'm going to get them today. You know, I love these advertisements for these guys who write books about in charge, and you've got to close, close, close. Sadly, that is a piece of negotiation. But what happens is people never climb the ladder with that mindset. They never think about agreements. They never think about vision. They never think about emotion. They're tactically out there attacking the world. And unfortunately, they're not building the respected business relationships they could be building. And you know, it's kind of funny, Larry says, I mean, I'm going to convince them, but, well, let me tell you, it's been proven time and again that seatbelts save lives. And every day, someone of great intellect dies in an automobile accident not wearing a seatbelt. Look at the tragedy in New Jersey. So, you know, convincing is just not valid.
Okay, so we're going to be talking a lot about negotiation in the next hour. Why should someone who is reading the description about this interview even listen to it? Why should they listen to you, number one, and why should they be interested in negotiating? What's in it for them by learning how to negotiate better?
Well, everything they're ever going to have in their life is going to come from a negotiation, whether they want to agree with that or not. The agreements we make, Mike, are the agreements that carry us through life. Now, it's just that simple. And they should listen to this simply to say no to me and eliminate me. That's the reason they should listen to me. They should just say no to this, eliminate it, scratch it off the list, and move on.
Let's talk about closing. We've got consultants all over the world, and what they do is they set up appointments with potential prospects who may be a good match for consulting services. It's called an opportunity analysis, where they take this potential client through a series of questions. But their goal, well, they believe their goal may be to get in there and identify needs and to close the prospect. Should my consultants go into an opportunity analysis thinking about closing the prospect, or is that a mistake?
I think that's a terrible mistake, and I'll tell you why.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
When you think of closing, the only time you're safe in a negotiation is their world, their challenges, their vision. I have no idea if I can help anyone. That's their world. I have to go into their world and find out. Now, the fact that they're asking questions, that's excellent in a way. But if they're asking those questions, Mike, tactically, if they're using tactics, then they're easily losing a great deal of money and a great deal of opportunity. Now, if they're asking those questions, well-designed, well-thought-out questions based on vision of what can be delivered or what challenges they might be facing, if they're asking those questions based on the principle of brain function, that's very powerful. If they're using those questions to, shall we say, try to hook somebody or trick somebody into giving up information that's dangerous to them, that can cost them a great deal of money. Because what will happen, the agreement won't be reached because the business relationship will never be trusted.
How does a consultant take the focus off of closing altogether in the presentation?
It's really a principle. Now, let me go back to the definition of negotiation. Again, I did not invent this, Mike. This comes right out of the Oxford Dictionary. It's the effort or work to bring about an agreement between two or more parties, with all parties having the right to veto. Now, think about the right to veto. What do we do to someone who destroys someone's right to veto? What happens in our society? Let me give you an extreme. When you think of rape, is that not ultimately destroying or taking away someone's right to veto?
Yes, it is.
And if we catch that person and we convict that person, the punishment is terrible. Now, think of the person going in to meet with someone they don't even know, and they're trying to close. They're attempting to tactically take away that person's right to veto. They're building terrible barriers, and they don't even realize it. The amazing thing is if they give the right to veto openly and honestly and really own it as a principle of life, which it is, again, I didn't invent, amazing things happen. Barriers come down, checkbooks come out, and real solutions are found.
And when I said, why should someone listen to you, and you said, give them the option to say no. So should the consultants, when they go in for these opportunity analysis, start right out up front and say, I don't know if I can help you, but we can sit down together and go over some questions to see if my services may be right for you, basically saying, I'm going to give you a chance to say no.
What's really interesting to me is that do they really know if they can help them or not when they walk in the door?
No, they don't.
Of course. So for them to sit in a chair and say, look, I'm the greatest consultant in the world, and I know exactly what you need, and I can fix it. Just answer these few questions, and then let's get started fixing your world. How ridiculous does that sound?
Yeah, it sounds like they're full of it.
They are. They're amateurs. negotiators don't create objections, so they don't have to deal with them.
Let's talk about cold calling. I was reading how in your research on cold calling, you learned some pretty important things when you're developing your camp negotiating system.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what some of those things you learned about cold calling are?
Yeah. What's really interesting to me, Mike, is that when you align principles in a system, you know, with the camp system of negotiation, and we have been told, now what's interesting is on our website, startwithno.com, everything we have in there has come from our clients. We haven't really invented any of it, just what they've said to us. And what's interesting is when you align principles or laws of human behavior, when you align them and obey them, the opportunity for success is magnified dramatically. And what we learn in cold calling is nothing more than a negotiation. It doesn't matter that you're a stranger. It doesn't matter that you don't know anyone. It doesn't matter that you're nervous, that you're afraid. You don't want to pick up the phone. You have problems with that self-image or that confidence you talked about very early. And so what we learned is that it's nothing more than a negotiation. So the mindset is I have no idea if what we do even fits your world. Now, that's the truth. That the fact that our target market is a dentist, a doctor, a lawyer, a business person, a real estate broker, a printing company, you name it. I have no idea if what we do fits, and that's the truth.
How can a consultant, when making cold calls, avoid sounding desperate?
You know, everything we do, Mike, is to help people not sound desperate or needy. And we spend a great deal of time on that. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is we're going to have some fun here today, and we're going to speak for an hour. And hopefully you and I are going to accomplish a mission that I set up for myself, is that we're going to disturb your listeners. I really hope we disturb them to get them thinking about all these things. I really do. I don't want to be eliminated, but it's fine if they do eliminate me. But I want to attempt to disturb them. So in that effort to disturb them for an hour, they have to realize that this takes months and months of work. This is hard. This is not easy. So to not be needy, to fake it, is a desperate effort. So let's talk about that a moment. I would rather them go get a night job and work on their consulting business or their selling business or their negotiating business in the daytime to really truly get out of the need mode, to feed the family, to put some money in the bank. Maybe they work at a convenience store, maybe. But whatever it takes to not need a deal is the critical element. Now, we could spend a lot of time here talking about predators and how human beings are the world's worst predators, and the person that shows need is gobbled up by the tough guy or the tough gal. But that's really the key, is that desperateness has to go out of their voice. The voice has to calm. The voice has to be slow. The message has to be well thought out. The message has to be focused on vision, creating vision in the other side. For example, if the mission and purpose is to help someone discover that there are opportunities in their marketplace that could heighten their level of success, if that was the mission of the call, then a question might come out, be driven by that mission and purpose, that might sound something like this. Who do you have in your corner helping you maximize your market?
I like that.
But it's driven by mission and purpose, Mike, and there's no need in the voice. Now, we're all guilty of asking verb-led questions. Do, is, can, would, could. What are we seeking? We're seeking a yes. How do we appear? We appear to be stealing the right to veto, or attempting to take it away, or trick that person from saying no, because no one wants to hurt anyone's feelings. In fact, in most cold calls, the only reason people listen, even for 10 seconds, is the fear of hurting someone's feelings. So once they get tired of cold calls, they just hang up automatically. Hence, you get a call reluctance from the person making the call.
What's a technique that a consultant can use to put his prospect at ease and increase his chance of maybe getting through to the decision maker?
That's a great question. But let me take your word technique or tactic. Now, let me just describe what that is. As an old pilot in the Air Force, a long time ago, back in a different life, I was told that a tactic is designed to take advantage of a weakness in an adversary. I was also taught that a principle or a law or a rule always had the upper hand over a tactic. So if we approach this thing tactically, it can easily be handled by veto or easily handled by principle. So I'd like them to think in terms of, okay, this is what I offer, this is what I deliver, this is the benefit of what I deliver, and I'm not sure that any of that fits in their world. And then I'm going to ask them the question, what you just tell me no if it doesn't fit, so I save you time and energy and I save myself time. So by principle, I'm going to negotiate an agenda that's not a technique or tactic. You see the difference, Mike?
Yes, I do. Well, let's say, look, I'm sure in the earlier days you were making cold calls. Or you train your staff to make cold calls to generate business for your services.
That's right.
So what do you train your best guys? How do you tell them to ring up when they're making cold calls? What's the first thing they say when the person says hello if your agenda is to get an appointment?
The first thing we're going to do is, by principle, we're going to communicate their name. Hi, Mike. My name is Jim Camp, and I'm not sure that what we do fits. So if it doesn't fit, would you just tell me and I'll save us both some time?
Sure. What are you selling?
That's a great question. What are you buying, Mike? No, seriously. What we do, Mike, is we provide services and work for our clients in the marketing arena. And I was wondering who you have in your corner maximizing your marketing effort.
That's a great question. Who do you have in your corner?
Now, you see, if it's not asked properly or if the principles aren't in place, one of your marketing consultants somewhere in the world come back to you and might say, that camp is full of it, it doesn't work. Because I told him I was Jim Camp and I'm the marketing expert in the world and I work with XYZ Marketing and I'm the smartest XYZ marketing guy in the world. And so who do you have helping you? And I did it just like Jim Camp and it didn't work.
Well, tell me about that question. Who's in your corner? That's a specific question and it's designed for a reason, right?
Oh, yeah. It's designed to create vision of your cut man in your corner. Boxing. Boxing is the sport many people either watch at some time in their life or enjoy, or maybe they don't enjoy it, but they know that there's a corner man.
That's right, and they see the boxer surrounded by support.
They see the man with the stool, the man with the bandages, or the cold sponge, and it creates vision. See, because vision drives decision.
So your system, are they filled with specific vision questions designed to work?
We might make statements. We don't need questions. We can make statements. But the concept is, the principle is, the brain functions emotionally in decisions. All decisions are made 100% emotionally. That's a scientific fact. Now, Mike, I promise you that your listening audience is going to say Camp is full of it. Camp doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't make decisions emotionally. I use rational thinking to make my decisions. Well, the decision to try to be rational is an emotional decision. And that's a scientific fact. So to overcome that and to realize that the other person makes their decisions emotionally and justifies them intellectually is a big step in principle. See, what do we do, Mike? We walk in and we start presenting. We have this concept of need building. Need's a very dangerous word, which I work very hard to not use and for my clients not to use, because we start saying things, gee, I need to call Mike. I need to go to the store. And what does the word need really mean? Well, if you ask someone what it really means, subconsciously, you'll hear things like survival. Well, if you don't survive, what do you have? Death. So we subconsciously build our need by using the word. So what we do is we try to create vision around the challenges that people see. For example, in negotiation in Vietnam, wouldn't it have been nice if our government and the negotiators would have looked Ho Chi Minh in the eye or his emissaries in Paris and said to them, how can we help you rebuild Vietnam? How can we help you restore the greatness of Vietnam? What would you propose to us that would empower your universities and the great thinkers in your country to help your country grow?
Yeah, those are powerful questions, vision questions, too.
Sure. What would they have said?
They'd probably give some answers.
But what do we do? We're all powerful, right?
Right.
We're going to bomb you into the Stone Age. We're going to trade you this for that. We won't bomb you on Tuesday if you won't attack this city on Wednesday. That's collective bargaining.
Become an expert negotiator. You can read some of Jim's free reports and tips over at www.jimcampstartwithno.com. That's www.jimcampstartwithno.com. I see. Before collective bargaining, were they better negotiators?
Oh, masters. That's how the country was built. This country was built with master negotiators. In fact, Mike, some of the very greatest negotiators in the world today are Americans. I work with many very high-level master negotiators who immediately see what we're doing and embrace it because they do a lot of it already. They instinctively do it because they learned it from their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents.
Name one of your mentors that you really respect, that you've learned a ton from negotiating.
Oh, gosh. I would have to mention my father, who was a veteran of Pearl Harbor and built his own high-tech company and a master. Woody Hayes, my football coach from Iowa State, was a great mentor to me. I always prided myself in being one of his greatest students. probably one of the most powerful industrialists in the world today, is a client of mine. His name is on the website. Again, I have a confidentiality agreement, I can't disclose it. So I have mentors I talk with often.
If a consultant's in an opportunity analysis meeting face-to-face and he's asking questions and the client gets off track, what would you do if the client's getting off track to get them back on track?
Yeah, I'd kind of like to know why they're getting off track. You know, where am I screwing this interview up?
Well, I guess it goes to controlling the conversation. Are there ways to steer and control a conversation?
I'd like to be, but I'm not doing a very good job if they get off track, right? I'd just like to ask a very simple question. I'm falling short here. I'm not bringing you much benefit. Where's this really going? I'd like to know that. You probably recognize, Mike, that takes a lot of confidence. That takes a very solid comfort in your system. You know, what's interesting to me is we've developed our system. I want to share this with you just to give your consultants a little bit of an idea of where this really comes from. Back in pilot training in the Air Force, if you think about taking a young college person, man or woman, from graduation day in college to 15 months later, they're in combat in a supersonic fighter with sophisticated weaponry on a sophisticated battlefield. How do you do that? How do you get them from there to there? And I've heard people say, well, you do it with training, you do it with all these different things, but you really don't. What you really do is you put systems in place that solve problems. For example, on day one of pilot training, the instructor would say to you, okay, you've just taken off, your engine's quit, what are you going to do? A lot of people would say, well, I'm going to try to find a place to land. No, you're going to eject. Well, they've never done that. They don't know what it looks like. They don't have any confidence in it. So what happens? You study the ejection system in the airplane so that you see how it actually functions. Not only do you understand it, Mike, but you see it. They let you practice on dummy seats. They shoot you up a rail. They take you parasailing with a parachute. They do all these things to help you actually experience and see it. And they help you fail safely so you gain confidence. That's the same thing we do with our system.
So we talked about the Colombo effect. What do you mean by the Colombo effect?
It's an act of humanity, Mike, is what it really is. It's a principle of humanity.
Now, we're referring to the TV show Columbo.
That's right.
The detective.
Right. And he appears stumbling and bumbling and struggling, and it's an act for him. It really is an act, and he's being paid to do that. And we see people say things they shouldn't have said. They see him piece things together that they didn't even realize he was gaining. And we watch that, and we're just amazed by it. Well, in our society, people are okay. I've seen others more not okay than themselves. So what happens is you'll find that people feel comfortable with humanity, with someone being a human. The person who's very stuffy or very perfect in everything they do sometimes can be difficult to talk to or to share information with. But the person who appears human and is interested in what's being said and doesn't appear to know it all, doesn't appear to have a one-track mind, who appears to really care about what the other person's saying, that's what we're looking for.
So is that how a consultant could go into a sales presentation and allow a prospect to feel comfortable and safe, just to be human?
Absolutely, because what you're going to find is everyone wants to be with someone who's human. You hear people say, they're a good person. I really respect them. They really listen to what you say. And they take action on what you say. I really, really enjoy being with that person or speaking with that person, or I've got the greatest person in the world to talk to about this situation. That's because of the humanity. And what your consultants are going to find, Mike, is their level of success goes up, and as they go to higher levels in organizations and are dealing with the board of directors or the chairman of the board, they're going to find that those people are very human and very open.
The higher you go, the more open they probably are.
That's exactly right.
So how can a consultant be more human in a meeting or in his everyday consulting business?
Well, I think the first thing that has to happen, let's go back to confidence. Let's go back to not being afraid or needy with a person. You know, it's very hard to be human when you're overcome with the emotion of need. So I think that whole area of breaking that down and getting out of that need mode is critical to that humanity, if you will. You know, when you have a couple $1,000,000 in your pocket, it's pretty easy to be a nice guy, pretty easy to be easy to talk to. It's pretty easy to say, gee, I don't think I'm a fit. I don't really think I can help you. I think I would be wasting your money. It's pretty easy to say that when you're very comfortable and your humanity comes out.
So if there's consultants where there's a lot of them who aren't there, you know, they're just starting out, they're struggling to get their first client, the clients can probably smell it on them, they're maybe trying too hard. So I guess to fast track their success, would you recommend they fake that confidence, act as if they were already there?
I have to tell you, I would, but the key to all of this is that that is just an act. Without the system in place, they can't grow from the fear. They can't grow into really owning it. They can only act it.
There's no shortcut.
There are no shortcuts.
You're going to have to go through that pain, and as you get better and better, the confidence will come.
Exactly right. And you know what, Mike? Guys like yourself who are out there trying to help these folks, you're doing an amazing thing. The key is to help them recognize there is no easy way. You know, you hear the term, no free lunch. Well, you know, it's interesting. Ralph Waldo Emerson, which is required reading for my clients, in his essay on compensation. Now, I didn't invent this. Coach Hayes at Ohio State had us read his Ralph Waldo Emerson essay on compensation as often as we possibly could. And he believed it. He did it himself. And in that essay, Emerson says, if you would have it, pay for it and take it. And that was written in the 1800s.
If you would have it, pay for it and take it. What does that mean?
Take it. You pay with your time, your energy, your money, and your emotion.
That's good.
And you fail, embrace failure. For every good, there's a bad. For every equal, there's an opposite.
That's good. I've got a consultant. He had an appointment, and that's with a bunch of construction guys, and he went in his coat and tie. And he said to me, I'm thinking of ditching the coat and tie. These are construction workers. What is your philosophy on dress when it comes to negotiation?
What's he comfortable in?
He's probably more comfortable on his just casual clothes.
Whatever he's more comfortable in.
So don't go in and try and impress with a fake Rolex. A fancy suit isn't going to help you.
Yeah, fake Rolex is the worst thing you can do. If we're going to meet the President of the United States, we should dress accordingly. If we're going to meet a mom and a dad in a family environment, we should dress accordingly. It's what really allows you to be comfortable.
And it's going to disarm your client.
It's going to let them see your humanity, right? I wear tailored clothes. They're very nice, but there's no flash and no dash. Whatever I'm comfortable in, I wear.
Calling Mr. Spock, how can emotion screw up a negotiating deal?
Oh, my God, it's all emotion, Mike. That's the whole point. It is all decision-making, and decisions are made emotionally. There is no Dr. Spock. There never has been. In fact, if your consultants will go to January, I'm going to say 2006, it's either January 2006 or January 2007, the Harvard Business Review quotes the scientific medical study of the brain, and it's found that people who have lost the emotional portion of their brain through accident, disease, or whatever, are incapable of making a decision. There are no decisions. They can't even decide to tie their shoes. So everything in a negotiation is emotional. Now, the trick is to understand that and eliminate the fear of decision-making. People are afraid to make a decision for fear of making a bad decision. Well, our whole focus in our training is effective decision-making, and that's defined as a person who makes a bad decision effectively changes the decision almost immediately. So if you make a bad decision, you just make another one to correct it. That's really the key to negotiation. But if you become stymied in emotion and can't make a decision, you're stuck.
So what's the main difference between emotional-based and decision-based negotiating?
Well, decision-based negotiation is absolutely the recognition that you must make a decision to manage or at least attempt to manage the emotion. Can you really manage emotion? No, but you can greatly influence with decision-making.
What are a few common negotiating minefields?
Assumptions. They'll get you killed every time. Every time you hear someone say, Mike, I think, that is an assumption. Another one is compromise based on fear. So let's see if I can kind of put this in line for you. I'm sure you have consultants out there who believe in the win-win model. So what do? They get an appointment with a very big company or a very strong company who they think they can really help. They get excited about it, elevates the emotion. Then they start thinking about it. Well, wait a minute, I've never really worked with a company this big. In comes the fear. In the emotional side, they say, well, gee, they're probably going to think my prices are pretty high from my lack of experience. Maybe I better lower my prices a little before I go in. I know what I'll do. I'll prepare a BATNA. So we've got this whole chain of assumptions, compromise, assumption, compromise, fear, all driven by emotion. And they've got to stop that. That is a terrible minefield to get into. You almost never escape the minefield until you get tired of losing. The people that come to us are just tired of not getting to a high level. They've been so beaten up, they're just tired of it.
How can a consultant use an opponent's emotion to his advantage?
Well, the really great negotiators try to lower the emotion on the other side of the table. You know, when things look good and someone on the other side gets excited, this is great, this is exciting, whoa, wait a minute, we think this is good too, but there's a lot of work ahead. So the really great negotiators help bring people back to a more reasonable position. That's a very, very important aspect of negotiation.
Let's talk about the power of no. How can my consultants consistently negotiate good deals by starting with the word no?
The very first place to start is at home, in the office before the meeting. And if they'll just say, no, I'm not going to call this person, then the intellectual side of the brain will say, well, wait a minute, I just read where they're interested in penetrating this new marketplace, and I know a great deal about it. So they force their brain to function, and their brain starts to move. Yes, I should call them. No, maybe I shouldn't call the secretary. No, I'm not going to call the secretary. I'm going to see if I can get a number to the president, so I'm going to call at 7 o'clock in the morning. So you started with, no, I'm not going to call the secretary. I want to talk to the president. Then maybe intellectually a solution comes up. You call at 7 in the morning, and the president's already in and working, and you get him to pick up the line. So it's just that simple.
How about when a consultant's getting ready to go in to meet a prospect and he's thinking about charging a certain amount for his fees? Should he say no if he can't get those fees to the client and just eliminate the win-win, you know, something better than nothing?
Oh, my gosh. That's a terrible minefield to be in.
What do you have against this win-win model in negotiating? Can't there be some benefit for a win-win model?
Now, think about it just for a second.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
Something's better than nothing. Think about what you said. Something is better than nothing. So what do? We assume our prices are too high, or we assume they won't pay our price because they've said they won't.
What if they haven't said they won't, but you don't know, but you know during or after the presentation it could come to that? Do you make your decision before, or are you a little flexible?
Well, see, what's really happened is, Mike, the failure's not occurred in the presentation. The failure occurred in the lack of vision on the side of the adversary. They don't see the real problem that can be solved. It's never the price. It's always the vision of the adversary. That's the giant mistake in all of this. So we go to a win-win mindset because we want to settle for something, but we never solve the real problem. The real problem is we're not effectively helping them discover what the challenges are and what can be fixed.
Right, because if you do that, if you do your job in that meeting, they will see the value.
I wonder how many of your consultants say or hear the word cut to the chase. Just cut to the chase and tell me what you can do. And they take that at face value, assuming they have to cut to the chase.
Well, how do you handle that? What if you're in a meeting and someone says that? How do you respond?
Okay, let's cut to the chase. What is it we're really trying to solve? What are we really trying to do? What is the real challenge we're trying to fix?
So you put it back on them.
Absolutely. I have to say no without saying no to them. I have to say no. I can't accept cutting to the chase. Because if I cut to the chase, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to end up spilling all my beans, giving up all the information. I'll give up price. I'll create objections. And now I'm like typical everybody else. I'm average dealing with objections. And once I get to that point, my value goes dramatically down.
So say no. Don't cut to the chase and put it back on them.
Exactly. But you put it back on them. Absolutely. Let's cut to the chase. I don't have a problem with that. What is the real problem we're trying to solve?
This is how saying no can change the negotiating dynamics in a beneficial way.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It changes it all across the board, Mike. It changes the whole mindset. It changes what we're thinking when we walk in the room. I mean, if someone's going to push you around or treat you like you're a second-class citizen, are you going to say no to that, or are you going to hope to get something out of it? I would say no to that and say, look, I just don't think I'm the person that can help you.
Yeah, walk away.
No, wait. But guess what happens? There's an interesting thing. When the predator hears no, look, I don't think I'm the guy that can help you. I didn't walk away. All I said was, no, I don't think I'm the guy that can help you.
Do you create respect?
Oh, absolutely. You'd be shocked. Whoa, wait, okay, you're right. If they continue on, then it's fine to walk away. You can't win them all. But at least you have your self-respect. But on the other hand, those guys who, well, just let me show you what I've got here. Let me just present this to you. Let me just give you this. Here, you flip this over for 2 weeks, and I'll call you back and take a look at this. And they give all the pricing, all their ideas, all their thoughts, all their concepts and what happens. 2 weeks later, they've already hired another person to do it. They're paying a bigger firm to do it, and they've already taken his ideas and run with them. Think of the times, Mike, you've seen that happen.
What if you're in a meeting and you get a yes at the beginning of the negotiation? Is this real, or is it often a lie?
You know, it's kind of interesting that you said yes to me so early. Now I'm really worried that I haven't done a very good job helping you see the difficulties here. This is going to be much more expensive and more time-consuming, I think, than you think. Are you sure you really want to say yes this early without really digging into this? Notice the verb-led question. Are you sure? I'm hoping for a no, because I want to dig into it.
That's good. I like that. What about a maybe?
Oh, my goodness. I can't deal with that.
Why not?
I'd rather you just tell me no and let me go home.
You say that to him right there.
Oh, yeah, sure. But it's the truth. Because a maybe is just going to have me chasing you around circles. You're going to have to put up with me. It's going to eat up your time, your energy. You're going to get tired of my chasing you, and I'm going to get tired of chasing you, and we're not going to get anywhere, so I'd rather just let me go. I'll go home.
How do you blow a deal with one sentence? What are some of the deal-killing questions that consultants would ask?
Don't you think this is the greatest thing you've ever seen? Don't you think this will really make you happy? Isn't this something you think you ought to do? Doesn't this get you excited? Aren't you excited about this? All those kinds of verb-led questions trying to close the deal, they'll kill the deal quickly.
This is from the master of sales, Zig Ziglar, leading closing questions. I mean, this has got to work, right? This is Zig we're talking about.
Zig is a great entertainer. I love him. I love his draw, his Texas draw, with his arrowhead swimming pool. He's the greatest. I love him. I love him to death.
I mean, that was my first sales book, Secrets to Closing the Sale. Big,
sure,
thick book with the arrow and the red cover.
Isn't that fun?
It's great. I thought I struck gold.
You're out there knocking them dead selling $90 water softeners. I did it. $90 water softeners. Couldn't sell a single one for 3 weeks. Finally started asking me, just tell me no, you don't want to have soft air and I'll get out of here.
All right, so give me some questions they should ask instead of those leading closing questions.
Here's the problem. The problem is, if I said to you, well, Mike, what do you want me to do?
That's an open-ended question.
Interrogative question, right?
Yeah.
See, we identify interrogatives. I've had people say to me, open-ended questions. I said, well, give me an example of an open-ended question. I'll ask me a verb question. Yes, no, maybe. And they don't even know maybe's coming, and they're open for a yes. Then they get a no, and they stammer on themselves. We're really picky about those kinds of things. But, you know, what would you like me to do? Who just had to take responsibility for the decision? The other side, right? What would you want me to do? I want you to go home. Really? I can do that. Where did I fall short? But you see, it's all about agreements.
Can we use these questions to get our adversary to spill the beans?
Sure. What's the greatest challenge you're facing? What is the greatest challenge? What's the most difficult thing you face?
So questions are the answer.
Well, questions are the easiest way to create vision, right? See, people ask questions, don't even know why they're asking them. They think they're gaining information. What they're actually doing when they're properly asked is creating vision on the other side that will drive the decision. And once the real challenges are uncovered, and a lot of the conventional wisdom out there says needs, but I think that's a terrible word because it's really not what they're doing. What you're really doing is creating vision, and vision drives decision. And that vision in the adversary's world drives the negotiation.
Let's talk about getting to the decision maker. And a lot of companies have blockers set up. Explain what a blocker is.
Well, a blocker is just a person that's not qualified to negotiate, but will attempt to gather your beans, attempt to gather all of your information, attempt to know your position so they can start to pick it apart and turn it into collective bargaining.
So should we deal with blockers?
We have to deal with blockers, don't we? But, you know, the challenge is, how will this decision be reached? Who should I talk with? Now, is it perfect science? Of course not. But I don't know what to present because I haven't talked to the chairman yet to find out how he sees it. Without meeting the chairman, I really wouldn't know what to offer.
So is this a way to get around the blocker?
Yeah, without going to the engineering team and sitting down with them, I don't know how to respond to this RFQ. Or without going to your marketing team and sitting down with your market team, I don't know what they see the challenges to be. I wouldn't know what to present. But, of course, you're the president, so without my ability to come back to you after meeting with your marketing team, I just don't know how I can help you.
That's good.
Yeah, but you see, Mike, the key here for all the listeners in your audience, and I know you recognize this because we talked about it, but all of these things fit together in a systematic approach to this, and all these things tie together. They don't stand alone as one tactic.
It's a system that you
really
teach and train.
That's why you read what you read on the website.
But I definitely want to talk more about that system here at the end, what you have to offer. What about fatal friends? Should our consultants try and befriend a client without getting that respect first?
Here's something interesting. I was once told by my grandfather, who ran Jessup Steel in Washington, Pennsylvania, for 43 years. He was a steel man from England, came to this country through Ellis Island. And he once said to me when I was very young, I called people my friends. And he said, you know, if you have more than five friends in your life, you're doing a terrible disservice to yourself. You're lying to yourself. You're going to have some wonderful acquaintances. You're going to have some people that you have the greatest respect for. But a friend is someone that will hold your rope when you're hanging over a cliff, someone you call in the middle of the night to rescue you, and you can count on. So the word friend is a very important word. But respect, as you just mentioned, Mike, is the key. Who do we respect? You're going to find that the more effective people are, the more we respect them. The more effective we are, the more respected we are. Now, that doesn't mean they like us, and that doesn't mean they're going to work with us, but at least they're going to have the respect for what we do. So that word respect is the key ingredient to the business world. And you hear people in conventional wisdom say things like relationship and power. That's hogwash. There is no power. Power is an assumption. Relationship is a dangerous word because is that a family relationship, a loving relationship, a marriage relationship, a father-child relationship, or is it a business relationship, or is it a friendly relationship? I saw the fellows at Harvard talk about a business relationship, and 40 minutes later they were talking about a friendly relationship with the Japanese guests in the room. So it went from business to friendly in 40 minutes. So it's a business relationship built on respect.
How can a consultant avoid revealing his weaknesses and becoming easy prey when he goes in for a client meeting?
This is really important. If weaknesses are a problem, they've got to be presented up front. If I have a language impediment, I may say I have a language impediment. If I'm weak in the language, I may apologize for my weakness in language, but they please allow my interpreter to work with us. I don't know what kind of weaknesses they might have. If they can't hear and they're deaf, would you please give me the answers in writing? If I can't speak, I hope you'll accept my answers on this board. I'll write my answers down. So those kinds of things go early in the negotiation, and they're stated clearly, and they're negotiated so that they're not a problem.
Is there a classic negotiating mistake that you've seen over and over again that can give up one's position?
Oh, absolutely. That's the early and often assumption compromise mindset we talked about a little while ago. That whole mindset, Mike, of sitting at home or sitting in your car and just building into an emotional turmoil with assumptions and fears and then taking away the emotional fear by compromise, that's a terrible tragedy. It happens every day in our society. It happens every day in our government. It's a terrible thing that takes place.
What does it mean to blank slate, and how hard is it to do?
Blank slate is a wonderful tool that you have to develop over time. And blank slate comes from a comfort in the event. The more comfortable you are in the event, the more trusting you are of what's taking place in the event, the more chance you have of blanking your slate or blanking your mind. Athletes say getting in the zone. I know as a fighter pilot, I used to get in the zone and blank slate, and I was just reacting to the environment. It was wonderful. Just couldn't seem to do anything wrong. Yet when your voice is talking, those little voices that sit on both shoulders, and you're all over the place, you can't blank slate, you can't react. You almost become one with the moment because you're so well-trained, you're so disciplined, you're so comfortable in the environment. You actually blank slate and react.
This is the end of part one. Please continue to part two.